Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What made the Dallas neighborhood of Little Mexico the epicenter of Latino culture and community for generations, and what remains of this vibrant corner of the city today? Little Mexico once sat just north of downtown Dallas as Mexican immigrants moved into the area, starting with the arrival of the railroads in the 1870s. By the 1930s, the neighborhood had swelled to more than 15,000 residents, with schools, churches, and businesses catering to the bilingual but deeply patriotic immigrant population. Attorney and writer Sol Villasana traces its history in a richly photo-illustrated new book called Dallas's Little Mexico, which is part of the Images of America book series published by Arcadia. He has a book signing tonight at Ojeda's Restaurant at 4617 Maple Avenue that takes place from 5 to 7. Sol, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the first big influx of Mexican immigrants into what is now Little Mexico was in the 1870s as the railroads came in. Was it Mexican laborers first, and then the men would bring their wives and families later?
Well, also, not only laborers were connected to the railroad and some of the other emerging kind of industries there in the early part of the late part of the 19th century, but also traders between back and forth between Mexico and Texas and points in Mexico and Texas were a common thing for going back 200 years. So you had a lot of the traders. It was and they primarily traveled alone and would go back to Mexico. It was really the revolution in 1910, it really began to change the complexion of the travelers and the migration, because at that point you had people coming in with their entire families and not necessarily prepared to go back. It was the revolution lasted over 10 years, so they were not assured that they'd ever be able to go back to Mexico.
And did the people who came during the revolution have different sort of resources than people who had come before as traders and as laborers?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real cross section of people leaving Mexico at that time. Of course, those were people concerned with the politics, people just concerned about the violence, as mm-hmm. you see today. You see a lot of what that can do to a population in any country where you have a war going on, people fleeing that. So you have a great variety of different kind of skills and coming in across and professions coming across. It's been estimated upwards to 10% of the Mexican professional population in that time left the country and came to Texas.
That must have been an interesting mix of people, because you had people who had some education and some resources living side by side with people who had come simply for the opportunity to work. Was there tension?
Well, because also, too, there was once you get here, even though you may have a doctor's degree or run a newspaper or something in Mexico, you had to find work.
Yeah.
And the discrimination that Mexicans faced at that time in Texas was still very strong. And it was not 100 years after the Alamo when this is going on. And so you have people who may have wanted to work and had skill sets which were a little different than just building a railroad. However, they still faced the obstacles of discrimination against Mexican Americans. So they took what jobs they could find, or many of them, like my family, just started their own businesses. Started trying to put together and realizing that you had a community beginning to develop. And you had to provide services for those communities.
What's really interesting about a lot of the businesses that started was that initially they served strictly that community of Little Mexico, mm-hmm. and then so many of them moved across the city and are now institutions.
Oh, one of my favorite examples of that is the Luna's Tortilla factory. Mm-hmm. Maria Luna started the factory back in the early 1920s. She's a widow. She had two children who helped kind of put the business together and get it going. And the idea was at that time she couldn't really rely on the Mexican women to necessarily leave their home and come to work. So she'd take the tortilla, the masa, out to them in the morning, and they would make them and pick them up in the afternoon and bring them back to the factory for completion. But Luna's really focused on what can we do? We can continue to sell tortillas here in the community, which mm-hmm. they had a good foundation for that. It's when they went out and began showing the restaurants and stuff throughout the city what you could do with a tortilla that they really began to kind of flourish as a business, because, of course, they found a market throughout the community.
And we continue thinking of new exotic ways to use tortillas.
There you go.
Today.
There you go.
I love thinking about the way that different neighborhoods transition over time, What was Little Mexico was initially a settlement for immigrant Jews?
Yeah, the just like the immigrant Mexicans coming in a few years later, a few decades later. The first, you got one thing about, which was fun about the book is looking at the topography of Dallas, of any city, early kind of an early community. You begin the Eastern European Jewish community, which was actually called Little Jerusalem by some people, which was to become Little Mexico, was just north of downtown, as you said, along just north of a creek called Dallas Branch, and it was a pretty major branch. It was wet and nasty with mosquitoes and all that kind of. In fact, if you look at Woodall Rogers today, you can see, you wonder why it's so deep down there. Well, that's where the creek was. And you can see the topography, how it dips down from downtown and then goes back up when you get into the McKinney and the uptown area. But, yeah, the Jewish community there needed to also find, this were mostly Eastern European Jews. The earlier German Jews, like the Marcuses and Sangers, were living in a different part of town. The Eastern European Jews found these smaller little wood frame homes in the what we become Little Mexico, and they started their own little businesses. They're mostly, in fact, I had a great story from looking at one of the Mexican churches, the early Mexican churches, was the Primera Iglesia Bautista, the first Mexican Baptist church. They got their own first building in 1918 down on Alamo Street. And it had actually been an early synagogue, an Eastern European synagogue, and they bought the building, and you can see there's a wonderful picture of the little Star of David and the other ornaments on the old building. But the Jewish community were very much like the Mexican American. In fact, Pancho Luna, who I referenced earlier, the Luna Tortillas, he remembers growing up and as a little boy there and learning Yiddish before he even learned English.
I love that detail in the book. Yeah, and he was not the only one.
No. The Domskys, the Tobolowskis, the Rubinets. The Rubinets store was a famous store down there. They were all and stayed even after the Mexican American community began to really populate the area. Many of the old Jewish community, especially businesses, hung on.
So churches were a huge part of the social life in Little Mexico.
Oh, very definitely, very definitely. Now, we often think of just the Catholic Church when we think of the Mexicans, but I think I illustrate pretty clearly in that book.
Many, many varieties.
There were many, many variety of flavors of religion in Mexico, just like it's in any community. The Protestant Church was proselytizing pretty heavily, even in Mexico at that time. And so you had the beginnings of the Baptist Church, the Methodist Church, the Rio Grande Conference eventually began just to service of the Methodist Church, to service the spiritual needs of Mexicans in Texas, and so you begin to see how, and of course they since they had property, had a building usually, oftentimes assisted by the dominant religions or their congregation or the main headquarters, they were able to get these properties. Some of them pretty beat up and old, but nevertheless they had a property, and you had a meeting house. And also, oftentimes, a school attached to the churches, which was another very important thing.
Now, there's a little bit—I don't want to say a scrap because it's been preserved—but St. Anne's School is still here in what is now Uptown Dallas. Mm-hmm. And initially, the focus there was on educating girls.
Yes, and that's primarily because the Catholic diocese was, from my understanding and looking at the research, was reluctant to allow young girls to go to Ursuline, which was the girls' school.
Because they were Mexican.
Because they're Mexican American, so you had. They needed to find some sort of outlet for having the girls educated. And it started out as a commercial kind of school, especially at the higher level, like high school, typing, things like that. But, yeah, it was, again, some of the discrimination actually drove even the development of the schools.
Now, the high school that is now sort of tucked behind the Plaza of the Americas, I forget the name
Cumberland
of it.
Cumberland Hill.
Yeah, well, it's still Dallas High School.
Dallas High School.
It's downtown.
Correct.
The building is still there. Mm-hmm. Any idea what's going to happen?
Well,
it was
the St. Anne School, which I was involved in the landmarking for from a legal standpoint, was the first building to be landmarked in Dallas against the wishes of the owner of the property.
Huh.
And that was
1990. They wanted to sell it?
They wanted to sell it without any kind of restrictions as far as historical landmarking ordinances. That was a year fight of trying to get that done, but we were able to accomplish it, and thus the school is still there and is landmarked and protected. A year afterwards, Crozier Tech went through the same process, and it is now landmarked. So there's restrictions as far as tearing it down and what you can do to the exterior of the building. But again, one thing that I've come realized from a legal angle and as the lawyer for the old St. Anne's Group and writing the book is that you can utilize the law to protect a lot of old properties and protect certain community interest and cultural interest in those especially those historical ordinances which dealing with properties have been very, very important. And it's a relatively new area. And once you get them protected, you can look at things like adaptive reuse, which is the kind of term they use when trying to put these old buildings to use again and make them the old Parkland complex on Maple at Oak Lawn that the Crow Holdings just put together. It's a beautiful, beautiful old building now, almost 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful old campus full of 100-year-old oaks. Crozier Tech could be used that way also. St. Anne's School is now St. Anne Court that Harwood International developed. So you can see it. And probably the first one is also in the book. That's the Cumberland Hill School right behind the Fairmont Hotel.
Hmm.
That was put together as an adaptive reuse. It's a very old school, very old public school, and it's a lovely office building now.
Now, another school that the name still exists that served children in Little Mexico, but it's a different building, is William B. Travis.
Yeah, and that's still they still have a little campus over at the top end of McKinney,
mm-hmm.
And it's the second version of the school. I mean, the first version actually was burned down by one of the students. So
I read that it was arson. I wasn't sure if it was some kind of racially motivated thing.
No, I think a student just got upset at the school.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was. But no, it's still functioning as a school. Even a little farther north on McKinney, you have the old North Dallas High School, which is a very old school as well. It still has many, many kids going there from all over the world. They have some of the most international schools in the area, as I understand North Dallas.
So was it inevitable that Little Mexico would sort of fade the way it did, given the value of the real estate ultimately this close to downtown?
Yeah, I think you mentioned it in your opening. The issue is really urban transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Things like creeks and typography are no match now to any developer. It's always kind of funny. I remember when we had some bad flooding here not too long ago. Now some people always wondered where these floods come from, and we've covered all these creeks up.
We can't absorb that water anymore.
They're under there, and they've just been covered up. So that is not a barrier. And foul-smelling Trinity River, of course, was even moved. We rechanneled in the downtown area. So all this can be taken care of, and if you're a real estate developer, it's something you will do to increase the value of your property. So, yes, it was inevitable. When you began to see a need for people coming back into town or closer to downtown to work, and the need for more entertainment districts. Where could you put a big thing like the American Airlines Center? You know, you can see how that can be. If you can, put it out in the suburbs, but if you want to put it into the inner city area, it's got to be a place that you can go in and buy some property. So, Little Mexico was pretty much in that sense a target,
mm-hmm.
and the landowners were from anyone who really knew it was going. Both the scrupulous and the unscrupulous land developers. So yes, it was a matter of changing. And what I like about it is, as you mentioned, it's the Hardwood District in particular around here, around the station, is one of the more attractive and kind of thought through urban projects. I mean, you have a mixed use of people living and still walking and working downtown, walking their dogs in the afternoon, you know, things like that. That's though the car still kind of, and the automobile still sort of rules as far as Dallas is concerned. You're beginning to see the value of DART and rail and people not having necessarily commute in an automobile, and places like Uptown and Harwood District do show that.
Which is an interesting sort of tracing back to its roots, and that people didn't necessarily have to commute by automobile when they were living and working in Little Mexico.
Yeah, and a terrible irony is here, it was the railroads who built Little Mexico, and it was the roads who killed it.
My guest this hour is attorney and writer Sol Villasana. His new book is called Dallas's Little Mexico. He will be signing copies of the book tonight at Ojeda's Restaurant on Maple Avenue in Dallas from 5 to 7. If you'd like to join our conversation, maybe you have a question or a memory of Little Mexico, we'd love to hear from you now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back. Funding for THINK comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Dallas attorney and writer Solvia Sana. His new book is called Dallas's Little Mexico. He'll be signing copies of it tonight at Ojeda's restaurant on Maple Avenue in Dallas from 5 to 7. There's also a signing at the offices of Preservation Dallas on August 10th from 6 to 8 in the evening. Those offices are on Swiss Avenue. If you'd like to join our conversation and share a memory of your own or perhaps a question about Little Mexico, we'd love to hear from you now. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. So, Sol, in the interest of getting other people to sort of open up with their memories, and talk about what you remember. Did actually grow up in the neighborhood, or did you have family in the neighborhood?
No, both. Mm-hmm. There's different sections of Little Mexico. Like the dividing line in many ways was Harry Hines or Turney Street in those days, what it was called, which runs north-south. So the west side of Turney was a little rough and more tumbly. We had a lot of cantinas and saloons and brothels and all kinds of interesting things like that over on that side. And oftentimes the children were told, don't cross the street. Don't go over that side of the street. So I had little families. Some of the stories are just wonderful. That's probably been the highlight of writing the book, is talking to people about the wonderful stories and the nicknames of people. Because everyone had nicknames in the barrio. Everyone had.
What was yours?
We're talking historical stuff. I'm going to talk about 50 years ago. One of my favorite nicknames was Pancho Pistolas, Pete Pistolas, and of course he carried two guns, not just one. So the kids had all kinds of names, but they were wonderful stories. There were the ghosts over here, the famous ghosts who used to inhabit the Pikes Park building, the gold and treasure stories, all kinds of treasure stories about people digging up their yards since the communities, the Jewish community and the Mexican community came here initially, they didn't really were putting their stuff in banks. So
they would bury money in the backyard.
People would find things. Mm-hmm. These old houses would be demolished and they'd find all kinds of stuff in these old buildings. So the ideas of the treasures and the ghosts, they were maybe not so ridiculous.
So let's talk about Pikes Park. That is still there. It used to be called Summit Park. Is
correct,
that right?
Correct. It was on the coming out of downtown. It was kind of a little summit built on these chalk hills coming out toward Rivershawn Park, and the park was about that time there was a kind of desire to kind of clean up the more raunchier parts of downtown, especially where the old West End is right now. So putting in parks and things was important. In fact, the architectural firm that built Pikes, the rec center, was in 1914, was one of the most well-known architectural firms in the city. It was a beautiful old building, actually. And you can see how even it began to deteriorate. First, it was a very small park, only about 4 or 5 acres. And when they started doing the reopening and paving of the streets, like Harry Hines going out to Love Field, they started taking away parkland and making it even smaller. Mm-hmm. So you begin to see how, and then they took off the third story. And so there's all this kind of thing where the poor park has been kind of reduced to a very postage stamp type thing. But nevertheless, it still is the kind of main draw for a lot of the celebrations at JCC's, September, the Mexican Cinco de Mayo, even the Veterans Day celebrations are still held over there. So it's still a real important part of the Mexican American community, and especially historically and culturally.
I was surprised to read that at Pikes Park and maybe Summit Park in the past, there were times when Mexican American kids were not allowed to swim in the pool.
Yeah, that's a very, very, very common occurrence. My father could remember growing up, and this is way after Summit Park, decades after Summit Park, and the Jewish kids and the Mexican kids kind of fighting over the pool. He can remember quite clearly trying to get into public pools in Dallas and not being allowed because he was Mexican.
Hmm. What was the language balance like? Did everybody speak Spanish and
everybody,
also English?
Everybody spoke Spanish. Mm-hmm. And of course, you can go to ethnic neighborhoods today anywhere in the country, and you'll see that kind of importance of language. And language is very, very important in the development of the barrio. Everyone spoke Spanish. There was certainly a desire to learn English. I mean, my father went to night school to learn English. He something he wanted to do and become a citizen and become an American. But at the same time, that was the cohesion that brought and the glue that kept that community together was that the ease of being able to go out on the street, go on your sidewalk, talk to your neighbors in Spanish, go to the store and buy your tortillas or go to the cantina and have a beer, and it was all that kind of, or to the church, mm-hmm. and the language and the importance of the language in the services offered to the various churches.
The other huge thread that runs through this book is the patriotism, which I think a lot of people today look at new immigrants and for whatever reason don't acknowledge their extraordinary patriotism for their adopted country, and we definitely see that here.
Oh, that one photograph from, I think it's actually a 4th of July celebration, not a Dieciséis or a Cinco de Mayo celebration, a 1926 or something, I have a photograph, and you see it there at Pikes Park. Wonderful panoramic view, kind of looking to the, what was, there's nothing much to look at Dallas that way, to the southeast, but there it is. And you see American flags, Mexican flags, the band, all the trappings of a celebration for 4th of July. And so these are people who had only been here in the United States and in Dallas and Little Mexico 4, 5, 6 years, and they're celebrating 4th of July in a grand way.
A lot of Little Mexico's sons, in particular, went off to the Second World War.
Yes. The war was a real transition for the neighborhood because at that point you begin to have that younger generation going off, and to the war in particular, they went off to see other lands, you know, and it's kind of like how you keep them back on the farm, you know, like the Yassine Puri, that kind of thing. And you have that coming back and being quite proud of being Americans. And they were not just Mexicans, and they weren't just Americans in a way. They were liberating Americans as far as they saw themselves across the world as servicemen and women in the war, in World War II. So they came back with a real desire to keep moving on and not kind of take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so you have organizations like the GI Forum and other veterans groups begin to work for better education, better housing facilities, breaking down the walls of discrimination. That generation was just going to be moving forward. And so also, too, though, they came back with benefits like educational benefits, housing benefits. So it also helped them move out of the neighborhood, move out of the barrio, and look at some of the other options they had for educating their kids, which is very, very important in the Mexican-American community. And these poor old schools, and you mentioned like to the Travis and Cumberland, those schools were pretty bad off even 40 years before. And at that point in time, they were really, really inadequate. So the educational issue became important. And Mexican-American families realized if they were going to give their kids a good education, they had to start thinking about moving out.
Mm-hmm. So you had, I guess, for a time, just the older generations remaining?
True, true. You could snack back. You can look out your windows through the studio and see about maybe a half a dozen little small frame houses. And that's pretty much all that's left. And they wouldn't be there had they probably sold out a few 20 years ago when this began to develop. But there's just... there was just only that first kind of group of settlers, and some of their children hung in. A few of the businesses, you know, the VSI still have a little business down here, but it's the issues like parking, and it just became really, really impossible to continue to thrive as a business down in this area, and it was just destined to be something else, and which it is, and it's still there. There's a small plaque over there at the Katy Trail, which talks about how this was a kind of a brownfield. You know, you had a dump over here in the Little Mexico area. You had nasty industries like the power company with the coal and grain elevators. And they talk about how beautiful it's been reclaimed. But sadly, it doesn't even mention at all the people who lived here before that, who put up with that.
I think one of my favorite holdouts, and I think he's gone now, but if you look out our window, there's a little bank.
Yes.
And in the parking lot of that bank is a very typical, perfectly preserved example of the sort of architecture that we saw throughout Little Mexico.
I think it's the Rodriguez family, I think. But he died recently. Mm-hmm. But it's those little houses, even though they might be 100, 120 years old, are perfectly repaired and preserved. And that's how the Mexican-American community took care of its neighborhood. Even though the houses weren't grand and great, they used to have several garden clubs competing mm-hmm. with each other about who's going to have the best lawn and the best flowers, and they'd decorate the common areas at the housing project, Little Mexico Village, over here across the street. So it was quite. They were quite proud. In doing the book, the research of the book, I began to realize there wasn't a lot written about Little Mexico from a scholarly standpoint. SMU and some of the people out there did some work during the 30s and 40s, but they looked at it as a kind of how do we help a blighted area kind of study. You know, there was a little interest in of course, the Depression was going on and all. So there was a concern about poverty and those kind of things. But the people who lived in the community and my family, we didn't see it that way. This was home. Mm-hmm. This was home, and we kept it nice, and the buildings were good. And as you can see, you can still see these little buildings outside the street, and they'll be there forever until someone buys them and tears them down.
So what do folks who have a history in Little Mexico do in order to get together with people from the old neighborhood? It's not so simple as driving to Abuelita's house and you can just hang out.
No, it's the lot of the school organ alumni groups are still real active in doing that. And still keep the old audio in their hearts and in their minds and a good source of photographs and history. The churches, the last church, the Emmanuel Methodist Church, finally had to move out only about 10 years ago. But they also are very, very attached to the area, and they bring together generations, various generations who have associated with the area one way or the other. So the churches, the alumni associations, any kind of historical group, when working with Preservation Dallas, so you can see how that's a real premier group in trying to not only save old important buildings, but to keep history kind of alive and important to people.
Talk a little about your process going through the photographs. I imagine the first thing you did was put a call out to people who had history here and say, what do you have that I can look at? How did that work for you?
It was not as easy as it might sound.
It doesn't sound easy at all, actually.
The Mexican people are proud of their heritage. They're not necessarily eager to just turn over their photographs, their personal photographs, to maybe a stranger. Mm-hmm. So it took some work to reach out and find all the people who were willing to do that. And then you have just the basic issue of old photographs. You know, we all keep stuff in a closet or under the bed, and just trying to find stuff like that, especially after 50 years, is not easy to do. So it took a lot of patience in working with people and trying to, and their patience in working with me, mm-hmm. and my editor's patience in working with me and getting that all together. It takes a little longer than you would think, because it's a real personal process. You don't just go in and ask somebody, oh, give me your pictures. You know, mm-hmm. It takes a little work, and we need to sit downs with coffee and tea and doing that.
I would imagine, too, and most of these are really well labeled, but there's a few where you know, somebody's first name is all you have.
Yeah. That's one of the regrets, is not having a little bit more time to be able to put together and get together the names of all these people. Now, some of the older ones, that's going to be pretty impossible to do. Mm-hmm. But the ones from the 40s and 50s, I think if we do a second edition, maybe we can get together and get some of these names kind of pin down.
Does it become like an obsession after a while?
It does. It really mm-hmm. does. I'm sort of obsessed about history anyway. I love history and I love writing. Mm-hmm. But putting together the photographs and your own people's history is become a driving thing in your life.
So let's talk about what people did to party in Little Mexico.
Well, there's a wonderful photograph of the El Phoenix dining mm-hmm. ballroom. It's a wonderful shot, and they're all in their tuxedos and having a good time on the full ballroom floor. There was places like that. Many of the restaurants had kind of adjacent ballrooms and all.
Is that the same El Phoenix that's still down there?
It's the same thing. That particular, I'm not sure if the ballroom is the same place, but mm-hmm. it's the same El Phoenix. And actually, the El Phoenix down there is actually extending into the old Luna's Tortilla Factory. So mm-hmm. it's going to be even a bigger complex. But the El Phoenix has been there now a long, long time, pretty much in the same spot. It's the original spot, which is down the street a little bit more, but it's pretty much that same location. That was a big, but there were dozens of businesses. I mean, I think in the book I put a 1950s program from the Pike Park celebration, and there were 41 different Hispanic-owned businesses in 1940 there in, or 1950 rather, in the area. 41, everything from bowling alleys to, which, and there's some great stories about the bowling alley, which is a little farther towards the downtown, to bakeries, to tortillas, to restaurants, to jewelry stores, all types of everything you would want in a community.
I would imagine those businesses were a pretty good source of dates and record keeping and things like that.
Well, the ones
that still exist.
Well, even some of them, like the Zambrano Photography, was one of the premier photographers during the 40s and 50s and 60s. Unfortunately, that place burned down. They lost all their archives. So sometimes even for the buildings and the businesses, it's kind of difficult to keep archives. Plus, as you know, if you have a business every day and you're going to work, you don't think anybody's ever going to want to.
Doesn't seem so exotic.
Yeah. You know, your old picture of your old place doesn't seem like an exotic thing to do at all.
And there was a movie theater?
The theater, that was the old Panamericana Theater over on Maple, just not too far from here. That had been actually the old original Dallas Theater Center place, and it was just a wonderful old theater. J.J. Rodriguez bought it in the 40s, an entrepreneur, a businessman who had a little small theater downtown, movie theater downtown. He fixed it up, turned it into the Pan American Theater for Spanish language movies, and had a great deal, a great business for over 40 years, bringing in different kind of movies. And it was a wonderful, wonderful old building, too, a lovely old building. And you can see what happens sometimes when you didn't have a preservation ordinance.
Yeah.
That building was torn down in the middle of the night by the developers who bought it, because they were trying to preserve it.
So essentially, they did it in the middle of the night so that they wouldn't attract attention while other people were trying to
keep it
in place.
Yeah. They used to do those midnight bulldozings. Yeah, they sure did. But yeah, Mr. Rodriguez would go around picking up kids and families and saying, "Come over to my theater, and you can come in free just to check it out and spread the word."
Was you said they were Spanish language movies? Were they translated like American movies, or were they from
Mexico
and Central America?
They were Mexican. The 40s in particular is kind of a golden age, from my understanding, of Mexican cinema.
I've seen the posters, and
yeah,
they're fantastic.
Yeah, they're kind of a golden age. So and Mr. Rodriguez is kind of in a good position, because he was bringing, just like any kind of theater, you'd bring in the stars and you have openings and all that stuff. So there's some photographs in the book of some of these characters. And again, trying to track down names is a good thing to kind of try to do, because it's kind of hard. Some of these, I could certainly use some help trying to find who some of the Mexican actors and actresses were back in the 40s.
My guest is Dallas writer and attorney Solvia Sana. His new book is called Dallas's Little Mexico. It's part of the Images of America book series. He's got a signing this evening at Ojeda's restaurant on Maple Avenue in Dallas from 5 to 7. On Wednesday, August 10th from 6 to 8, there's another book signing at the offices of Preservation Dallas in the Wilson Block on Swiss Avenue. If you would like to join our conversation, we'd love to hear from you. You can send email with your memories or your questions to think@kera.org. You can also call us, rather, at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is attorney and writer Solvia Sana. His new book is called Dallas's Little Mexico. If you want to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Joe, who writes, "In the 1950s, when I was a small child, my parents used to take me to a restaurant called El Poblano. Are you familiar with it, and do you happen to know exactly where it was located?"
I mentioned El Poblano in the book as one of the several that businesses that were in Little Mexico. I think I remembered it as well, but I would have been a really young kid like that. There were some. I remember going back with my father on weekends, and we'd hit several different places. We also try to point out in the book, there's several connections between Little Mexico and the community at large.
Mm-hmm.
Little Mexico, in a way, especially as you get into a downtown area, was kind of connected to the old State Thomas Black African-American area. So there was a kind of a bridge there. There were bridges over to the West Dallas Mexican-American neighborhoods across the river. And so you there's a lot of back and forth amongst many of the ethnic groups. And down in Deep Ellum, another situation, there was a Mexican neighborhood back down in that area. And that was, again, a primarily African-American area in some ways. So you could see a lot of that. So we could, by the 50s and 60s, when the cars were kind of taking over the world, you would be going all over the place like that in Dallas's ethnic kind of enclaves.
So those were good relationships by and large?
Good, very, very good relationships. You know, where there were still, of course, in those days, that strong sense of segregation, especially for the African-American community in Dallas. But no, it was, there was good relationships between, I think, I think it spilled over into this modern generation. We've been able to work together on a variety of issues.
There were other neighborhoods throughout the city where Mexican-Americans settled as immigrants. Why was Little Mexico sort of the epicenter?
Well, again, because of just a simple thing of like some of the services, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you needed tortillas, you need pan dulce, you know, sweet breads or bakery, you had to come to Little Mexico pretty much,
mm-hmm.
especially early on. There began to be, of course, in the other neighborhoods, they began to settle in with some of those same services. But the churches is another example. There used to be the Catholic Church, the Guadalupe Church here in Little Mexico. The Mexican Catholics in some of the other areas, like the Eagle Ford way out, or Cement City way out into the west of here, 6-7 miles away,
mm-hmm.
they would walk the Texas and Pacific Track all the way east into Little Mexico to go to church. Because that was the only church. Many of those towns, especially Cement City, were company towns. You're lucky if you had a bed, much less a church.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Virginia in Dallas. Hi, Virginia.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Yes, ma'am. I'm Virginia Waddle, and I'm blind now, but I was a public health nurse there in Little Mexico Village.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about that. Did you like the work?
I loved it. But I wanted to speak to that man that wrote the book.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's right here.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello, how are you?
His name is Saul?
Saul, exactly. Viasana.
Say that again.
Saul Viasana.
Okay. I'm sorry. I was a public health nurse there for many years in Little Mexico Village.
Right.
And I loved it. And I knew Sister Camilla. I used to be the nurse at the St. Anne's School.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And those were the smartest children there. Sister Camilla was their principal.
Mm-hmm. That's right. My stepfather would be happy to hear that. He went there.
And Little Mexico Village is still there.
Still there. Still there. Mm-hmm. It's still owned by the Dallas Housing Authority. And like I said earlier, the schools and the Housing Authority began to bring in professionals like our caller. Nurses, doctors who are, you know, begin to see the needs that you need for kids and older people, just the regular kind of stuff you had to have mm-hmm. in a community.
It's ironic now, though, that area of the Dallas Housing Authority is isolated from a lot of other residential areas now, as opposed to being right in the center of things.
Right. Of course, there's been a lot of litigation in recent years about public housing and where mm-hmm. you can put in things like that. So it's a much more complicated issue, public housing now, than it was back in the 40s when the Dallas Housing Authority was developed.
Did most people in Little Mexico tend to own their homes, or did they rent?
Initially, it was rental. 95% of the properties were rental properties in an early part of the 20th century. But it began to see a lot of home ownership. Mexican-American communities are a very industrious community. It tended to be a cash economy. So you had people saving up their money and going ahead and buying these small houses, which were, you know, cheap compared to the housing cost throughout the rest of Dallas.
One thing that's sort of interesting to do is if you go through this neighborhood, to this day on foot, there are some empty lots, but you still see the concrete staircases and you'll see, you know, spectacular crepe myrtles and you can sort of imagine what was there.
A dear friend of mine who actually kind of alerted me to doing this book, her issue was landscaping, and mm-hmm. when she did her work on Little Mexico, it was just looking at the landscaping and seeing where homes used to be, someone's home, and the flowers that would bloom and things like that. Yeah.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak with Larissa in Dallas. Hi, Larissa.
Hey, How are y'all doing?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
I gotta say, this is great. This is like a memory lane for me. I'm 51, grew up in Dallas. I got my first kiss at Pike Park. And I want to try and make it to O'Hara's tonight because, you know, for me, the mark of a true Dallasite is somebody that went to Pike Park. And Little Mexico, a lot of my friends' mothers worked down at the Maquiladoras there. And I was raised Irish Catholic. I went to St. Monica, Carrie, and TJ. But all my Chicana friends, I was introduced to Catholicism and Mexican style through going to all the festivities down at Pike's Park, Little Mexico, going to the quinceañeras, the weddings, just wonderful memories for me, and I really appreciate the work you did on your book.
Thank you very much. You asked earlier, Chris, about some of the entertainment. There were various social clubs, too, a lot of social clubs. Club Capri was one of the big sponsors for dances. It was always big, formal kind of operations, and down at the old Baker Hotel or the old Adolphus Hotel, places like that. So you had a variety of social organizations that were that focused in on the quinceañeras or the big balls, holiday balls, things like that.
Larissa's comments are interesting, too, coming from an Irish family, and she said she had friends and was sort of introduced to Mexican culture by her friends who lived in Little Mexico. Mm-hmm. Was that something that the people did from other parts of the city? Did they go into Little Mexico, or was it a sense that this was someone else's space?
Oh, no. Since we're sort of centrally located, you kind of had to go through Little Mexico to get there. And that's one of the things the city recognized when they decided to expand the road, Harry Anson, to left field. You had to get there. You had to go through Little Mexico to get left field. Mm-hmm. So, it was a place to go. In fact, one of my favorite stories is not in the book, but is that Harry Hines or Turney in those days, this kind of main drag going north and south into downtown, was the kids at St. Anne's used to hear all the time Bonnie and Clyde fly through with their V8 Fords, their stolen V8 Fords, Capris, all the time up and down Harry Hines because it was a quick way to get out of town.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with, we will speak with Ben in North Dallas. Hi, Ben.
It's Ben.
Hi, Ben.
Yeah, I wanted to cite a case of talking about segregation. Mm-hmm. One of my friends in medical school was named Bob McMasters, but he was as Indian-looking as anybody ever was. He was in a family that lived across both sides of the border, and he could have easily avoided the draft in WW2. But he did serve, but on his way home from service, he went through Fredericksburg, Texas, where he was refused service in the bus station's restaurant. Two beers, and he would get to telling about that story and crying and feeling and really laying it on to you about it wasn't fair. But it was a very, very sad thing for me that something like that could happen.
Well, hopefully we've come a long way in Texas. We have a ways to go, I guess, Saul, in all living together well.
It's still states like California and Texas, and you can see some of the new immigration activity or laws, if you want to call them that. I find them ridiculous, but which tend to target people who are just coming over to work hard and they pay their taxes. It's and I think a lot of it is driven by racial discrimination. I'm not that old, I don't think, but I can still remember my family being told that the Mexican motel is down the street.
Really?
When we travel, yes, yes.
And was that in different parts of Texas or here in Dallas? I guess you wouldn't stay in a motel house.
It was in different parts of the Texas, yeah. Your callers are quite accurate. Especially in South Texas, the racial issue, was, of course, there's not a lot of African-Americans in South Texas, at least back in those days, but it was really aimed at the Mexican-American War, which your station did a wonderful documentary on about a few years ago. It was a racially kind of driven kind of war, and we had a lot of animosity by the dominant Anglo culture against Mexicans for many, 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 many years.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Catherine in Dallas. Hey, Catherine.
Yes, I was wondering what exactly are the Little Mexico boundaries today, as opposed to what they were originally.
Well, thanks for calling, Catherine. The boundaries were kind of fluid even back in the beginning. And of course, you can imagine it start to expand, too, as the population expand, like Chris mentioned in the opening, up to 15,000 people by the 1930s. So it would have been probably around the Katy Railroad track on the west, which is now the Katy Trail. and the river, going all the way to the river to the west. To the east, it probably would have been along the McKinney Avenue, Cedar Springs kind of avenue, kind of at its height. And then going up, maybe up to Hall or Bowen Street, or just south of the uptown kind of area there at Lemon, and then going all the way to downtown. Going all the way, they would, it actually crossed over at the little Dallas branch that I was telling you about, where Woodall Rogers is, the creek, and went on up into the ascending side of the creek to the south, going up toward Cumberland Hill School. So along that area, so I'd say that would be kind of maybe like Ross Avenue on down.
I'm guessing part of the reason you wrote the book was for this reason, but do you meet young Dallasites today who don't know that this ever existed?
Yeah, exactly. It's, and even though even young Mexican-Americans today or Salvadorians or whatever, they may not know the location. But what's really important is that the early Mexican-American community out of Little Mexico was really the kind of foundation of that next generation of lawyers and doctors and businessmen and women and city council people. Nina Martinez, the first city Hispanic city council person in Dallas, so her mother had a beauty shop in Little Mexico, and she faithfully represented the whole city, and that was at large districts at that time. Pete Aguirre, foremost architect in Dallas, he went to St. Anne's School. So that was an important generation who really laid the foundation for the tremendous growth of the middle class Mexican American community.
Given that a lot of your resource material for this book came from individuals with family history in this place, what do you say to families who might have treasures in terms of photographs and records and papers sitting around? What's the best way to preserve them and to make sure that they're available to, for future generations of historians and scholars and people with an interest in all this?
Well, try to get a hold of someone who really kind of has an interest in it,
yeah.
First. I mean, for a long time, I mean, when I was doing research on the book, one of the institutional archives had just gotten a package of wonderful photographs from the early Mexican communities along the railroad in Allen and Plano back in the 1920s. But they didn't have any idea who these people were, mm-hmm. or that institutional archive, or a way to track it down and connect the dots, you know, and maybe go back and do the research. So try to get it to people who have kind of an interest in doing that. And there are many departments of history, UNT, Beto Calderon up in the history department up there is a really good resource for that, and other different kind of resources who really have that kind of interest in doing the kind of nitty-gritty work that needs to be done, to preserve it, keep it together, and two, to kind of tie it all together to the bigger picture.
You mentioned maybe someday doing an updated version. Inevitably, when a book like this comes out, I have to imagine you're inundated with things that might have made it in had you known about them before. Do you have any examples?
Well, especially after my deadline. Got a lot.
It's funny how that works.
Yeah. As a writer, you can appreciate that. There's so much more. I think the stories are really great. I think we could do more with the stories and try to pinpoint some more of the people. But just the stories of the communities, the everyday kind of way of how the community, as we were talking earlier, began integrated with the African American community and the Anglo community as a whole. I wish we could spend more time on that kind of stuff because it worked really, really very well. It was in kind of a seamless kind of way.
In the same way, you mentioned that sometimes businesses are working day to day and they don't think there's anything that special about what they're doing. Do you think the city's ethnic neighborhoods today are sort of paying enough attention to what's special about living in those areas?
You just don't think about it. You just get to work and you're trying to make a living and for your family, and that's how it kind of works. You don't think it's something terribly special about what you're doing, but it is, of course, especially if you're first or second generation from another country. Yeah.
Well, the book certainly gives us a great handle on life in Little Mexico. It is called Dallas's Little Mexico. The author that I've been speaking with this hour is attorney and writer Sol Villasana. He has a book signing tonight at Ojeda's Restaurant on Maple from 5 to 7 and another on August 10th from 6 to 8 at the offices of Preservation Dallas. Sol, it's been such a treat to have you here.
Well,
Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Chris. I really enjoy your show. It's the best.
Thanks. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.